It's Monday, February 7, 2011. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Yesterday may be remembered by many Americans as Super Bowl Sunday, but from an historic perspective, it is far more significant in that yesterday marked the 100th anniversary of the birth of Ronald Reagan. The 40th president of the United States was born in small-town Illinois 100 years ago yesterday. And when we look at that life, there is no doubt that we see a life that literally changed the nation and the world. A good many Americans who are alive today were not yet alive when Ronald Reagan was president of the United States. Several others have simply gone on and no longer think of Ronald Reagan except as part of our historical furniture. But the reality is that Ronald Reagan is still very much with us as an historical figure and as a presidential legacy, as one who changed the course of American history, and as one of the nation's chief executives who is now recognized as a game changer. Ronald Reagan was not considered a game changer by the political establishment when he arrived on the scene. They considered it a fluke when he was elected twice to the office of governor of California, and they considered it certainly almost impossible that he would be elected president of the United States. Many Americans who were alive at the time and are alive now fail to remember that in 1976, Ronald Reagan almost wrested the Republican presidential nomination from the incumbent president Gerald Ford. That was my first political experience working in a presidential campaign, and it was in the course of that campaign that I had the opportunity as a volunteer to meet Governor Reagan, as he then was, and that was a moment I will never forget. When Americans think about the 100th anniversary of the birth of Ronald Reagan, several things should come to mind. One is the fact that individuals really can make a decisive difference. When you look at Ronald Reagan, you're looking at a portrait of small-town America. You're considering one who, in his birth and in the humble circumstances of his childhood, was not, by those who were alive at the time, destined for greatness. Many things have been said about Ronald Reagan over the last several days, but I'll tell you, one of my favorites was on National Public Radio. When a woman mentioned, and she was documented as being able to speak with credibility, a woman who was almost 100 years old herself from Illinois, who counted herself and is recorded as being the 70th of 72 persons saved from drowning by Ronald Reagan as a lifeguard. As a teenager, he was known as Dutch. And to this woman, he was literally not only a history changer, but a lifesaver, as well as for 71 others. But for those who are alive today, considering the legacy of Ronald Reagan, a couple of things are very important. Not only the fact that individuals really can make a difference, but that historical circumstances call for a very convictional response. What we see in Ronald Reagan is a convictional model of leadership. He was not one who sought the office merely to hold it. He was driven by ideas. Those ideas were established in deep convictions, and he was able to translate them into political principles and policies that the American people could understand. Ronald Reagan was not appreciated by the political establishment. He simply defeated them, and then he overwhelmed them, and then he spoke over their heads to the American people. Something else about Ronald Reagan is very important. We see a picture of political growth and maturation. You know, so often in the larger media and in the culture of the political elites, when someone is said to grow in office or mature, it almost universally means moving from conservative assumptions to liberal assumptions. But for Ronald Reagan, it was quite different. He was genuinely a great supporter of the New Deal and a great affirmer of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Only later, especially in the transition of the post-war period, did he come to conservative convictions when he saw that government was beginning to encroach upon the liberties of the American people and was beginning to choke the American economy, which is the engine of American liberties. And so when Ronald Reagan ran for governor of California, he already had a very clear set of political convictions. Those convictions were articulated in a very famous speech he gave in support of the Republican nominee for president in 1964, Barry Goldwater. That speech is now one of the most famous speeches in American history. He was considered a dark horse candidate for the Republican nomination in 1968, but he waited until 1976 and then, as we said, nearly wrested the nomination from Gerald Ford, and then 4 years later, he defeated Jimmy Carter. Many other things could be said about Ronald Reagan. He moved from a position of affirming a pro-choice position on abortion. He signed one of the most liberal abortion rights laws in American history when he was governor of California, to being a stalwart defender of life. And he was that consistently once he came to those convictions. And again, he made a real difference when he was in office. Edmund Morris, the authorized biographer of Ronald Reagan, mentions in Sunday's edition of the Washington Post five myths about Ronald Reagan. The first was that he was a bad actor. Morris suggests that even though he was in several mediocre films, he really was not a bad actor and was certainly not seen as a bad actor by his Hollywood compatriots. He was also elected, you may remember, as president of the Screen Actors Guild, becoming the only president ever to have served as a president of a labor union in his previous life. Secondly, Morris says, he was not just a celluloid soldier in World War II. He did serve mainly by making patriotic films, but Ronald Reagan wanted desperately to serve in combat. However, with the defective eyesight at 7 over 200, bilateral, by the way, as it was diagnosed, an Army doctor said that a tank could advance within 7 feet of him before he would identify it as either American or Japanese. So, even though he was brokenhearted over not being able to serve in combat, he did make a real contribution to the war effort. Third, and this one will surprise people, Edmund Morris says that he was really not all that warm-hearted. Not when it comes to effusive emotionalism. He's a man who came alive on camera, and he says Ronald Reagan wasn't cold, except when it came to talking about totalitarianism, but he was not warm and fuzzy. Like so many great leaders, he was somewhat detached in person, but very warm and effusive when he was able to speak to multitudes. Fourth, Edmund Morris says he was not only a campaign Christian. This is very interesting. He writes that Ronald Reagan was greatly shaped by the understanding of what was called practical Christianity in the early decades of the 20th century. He also makes clear that given an abusive and somewhat absent father, a father seen as a failure by those in the community, he was greatly influenced in his Disciples of Christ Church by this idea of a practical Christianity by which the average, ordinary human being could glorify God through extraordinary service. Edmund tries to argue that that is indeed a part of the motivation between Ronald Reagan's great drive and ambition. Fifth, here's one that will be of interest to you. Edmund Morris says, of all things, he was not an amiable dunce. That word, by the way, that construction of an amiable dunce was often used of him by his liberal detractors. Let me just read to you what Edmund Morris says. Really? Clark Gifford? Ronald Reagan performed successfully in 6 different careers: radio sportscaster, movie actor, trade union president, corporate spokesman, 2-term governor, and 2-term president of the United States. He wasn't hampered by a lack of intellect. Well, when you look at all of this, we can look back and be thankful in the providence of God for the fact that Ronald Reagan was available and willing and ready to serve as president of the United States. At the same time, the final message is also very meaningful to us. We need to recognize the limitations of all human service. At the end of the day, Ronald Reagan was a fallible human being with his own frailties, and he made his share of mistakes. But in the great span of history, when you come to the political calculation of political greatness, there's now no doubt that Ronald Reagan belongs in that pantheon of America's greatest presidents. Yesterday's Super Bowl was noteworthy for a good many things, and whether your team won or lost or didn't even make the game, one thing is interesting, and that is that the advertisements on the Super Bowl are always a barometer of where we are at this point in our culture. There are always some that are greatly entertaining, very cute, some of them clever, but also there are some that are, well, absent. Mark Oppenheimer, writing the Beliefs column for the New York Times, points out that one ad that was proposed didn't make it. This is what he writes. If you watch one football game all year, it will probably be the Super Bowl. And if you happen to glance at the signs held up in the end zone, at least one will probably say John 3:16. It's a reference to a Bible verse. And by the way, Oppenheimer in the New York Times has to quote the verse to make clear what it is. He quotes John 3:16, and then he says, this is the verse of choice for Christian spectators at sporting events and for Christian athletes who paint John 3:16 in grease paint on their faces. But according to Fox News, which broadcasts the Super Bowl, the verse you can see in the stands on television is not suitable for a commercial. The network rejected a 30-second spot centered on John 3:16 as just one example of an advertising culture that, and these are Oppenheimer's words, can be allergic to expressions of faith. The Fixed Point Foundation proposed the advertisement and produced it. Larry Taunton, its spokesperson, said that what they were trying to do is just tell people, if you're interested in John 3:16, here is what it means. As he said, last year I began to reflect on the Super Bowl, and I thought, if I had 30 seconds to speak to a billion people, what would I say? Well, he wanted to explain John 3:16, but in response, Fox Sports said this: Fox Broadcasting Company does not accept advertising from religious organizations for the purpose of advancing particular beliefs or practices. Now, Mr. Oppenheimer says, that's all well and good as a matter of corporate policy, perhaps, but it's a bit disingenuous, because after all, professional sports is infused with religious messages, and many of them will actually make their way into the screens of televisions as people are watching the Fox Sports Channel as they're watching the Super Bowl. Well, when it comes to the advertisements that made it, there'll be some conversation. But I hope there's at least some conversation about the ad that didn't. We're continuing to watch the unfolding situation in Egypt, of course, and as it now appears that Egyptian strongman President Hosni Mubarak is clinging to office, the question of his removal is not now so much if, but when. It is now known that the American administration is working with folks on the street there in Cairo and elsewhere to try to negotiate a peaceful exit. One of the things that is noteworthy, especially in the press coverage over the weekend, is that Western governments, those especially in North America and in Western Europe, are doing their very best to insist upon a peaceful transition. Now think about that for just a moment. It is one thing for politicians and heads of government in various Western nations to demand that a transition be peaceful. It's another thing to be able to make it so. The limits of diplomacy are probably never more apparent than in a situation such as this. Diplomats can say what they want to happen. They may have even backdoor forms of coercion in order to perhaps make some things happen, but there is no way that any diplomat from any nation outside of Egypt can make happen what that nation may determine would be best. That's true even for the United States of America. As you look at this particular story, what we need to watch over the next several days is what is unfolding about the character and identity of those who are actually involved in the demonstrations. As the New York Times, the Washington Post, and many other international media sources are now reporting, this crowd is still amazingly young. They are largely 19 and 20-somethings, perhaps also now joined by some older folks, who have gone to the streets out of frustration. One of the things that is frustrating them, and this is becoming more and more clear, is the lack of jobs. Several of the major international media have been reporting on the fact, as for instance the New York Times did over the weekend, that many of these Arab nations have been working hard to provide college educations for their young people. And yet, once they graduate, there are no jobs. Just remember, as you watch what's happening on the streets, that a part of this is certainly driven by an anger towards a repressive regime. Part of it is certainly driven by a hunger and a thirst for freedom and for a democratic form of government. But when you think about human needs and how those come to the surface in terms of intensity, the need for a job, the need for gainful employment, the need to be able to provide for oneself, the need to be able to earn money in order to have a spouse, in this case, very clearly, to have a wife and to have children, the ability to sustain a family, these things, for most people, are even more pressing needs than democratic forms of government and political freedom. And yet, as we know, they really do go together. And that's why all Americans of goodwill must hope that what happens in Egypt is not only a peaceful transition, but that it is a transition towards a form of government that will respect human rights and human dignity, and will respect its peace treaties with its neighbors, including Israel, and will indeed be a government that loosens the economy of Egypt to create a culture that produces jobs for the millions of young Egyptians who want them and need them. There will be no hope for lasting peace in the Middle East until all of those teeming young people in the Arab streets have an opportunity for a job as well as for the taste of freedom. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You'll find more information also by following me on Twitter at twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For more information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.